Okay? And there, this primitive interpretation, as there is obviously in Christianity, as there is obviously in Judaism. The question is, why does it get triggered at certain moments?
Well, I think it has been triggered continuously. And the difference, I might point out, is the spread of destructive technology. I mean, this is why we have to be so worried about these apocalyptic visions of life that essentially tell people that death is an illusion, and in fact, you get everything you want after you die, and that human history is going to end in some kind of glorious conflagration where the good people, if you're a Christian, are going to be brought up into the sky and allowed to witness this rather sacred end to human history. This is believed by people on all sides, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish, some subset of each. When you marry that to our technological capacity, which is not going away, I mean, we're not going to uninvent the knowledge about how to make weapons of mass destruction, it becomes an increasingly dangerous situation. I'm not soft-pedaling the role of Judaism and Christianity and other religions in this, and I'm not soft-pedaling the role of tribalism generally. Yes, we have to outgrow tribalism. We have to outgrow racism and nationalism. But these are all ideas. And what I find troubling here is the dismissal of the power of ideas. I mean, just imagine, what's wrong with this argument? Okay. Imagine going to Nazi Germany in the 30s and saying, you know, Sam, your criticism of Nazism is really misplaced. It's not, the problem is not Nazism, it's extremist Nazism. You know, most Nazis are good people. Most Nazis don't spend a lot of time thinking about the purity of German blood. They're nice grandmothers who love to see their grandchildren in those youth camps with their shirts off, you've seen those rallies. All those people have these great leather trench coats, some of our great sartorial gains were actually Nazi gains, and we shouldn't dismiss that. There's a lot of exuberance and joy in Nazism, and you have used extremism. You've used extremists like Hitler and Goebbels and Himmler to represent the whole. Nazism is a political ideology, okay, but we can talk about the principles around which people have rallied and what they say to one another about how they define themselves as different from other human beings. And religion gives immense motivation to this, and it is the only kind of tribalism in which people posit a transcendental difference between themselves and other people, where in-group and out-group becomes of consequence not only for this life, but for eternity, and to minimize the role that that's playing. I mean, I am not imagining the link between Islam and violence, to take Islam as one example, because the people who are perpetrating this violence are telling us ad nauseum why they are doing this. I mean, this kind of analysis is like going into a church on Sundays and seeing people lined up to receive the Eucharist and asking them why they're doing this, and they tell you about the transubstantiation and their love for Jesus. And to discount all of that, we can't trust what they're saying. Actually, this is just cracker eating behavior, and it as witnessed by the fact that it happens in other contexts. I mean, people eat crackers in other contexts, and there's a general love of crackers. You can't say that
Sam,
people are being motivated by their religion.
Well, this may be good fun. You have to explain why this religion takes hold at certain moments and does not at others.
I reject that analysis.
If the power is in the religion, and you say it's there in the Hebraic religion, only it's not operating now because Jewish mothers are not doing that. And we know in large parts of the Muslim world it's not operating. They don't read the Quran that way. They don't follow the religion that way, including large parts of the Arab world through much of the history. And then you have the example of Ireland, which was mentioned before, where you have Protestants and Catholics reading what should be the same text and killing each other for well over a century. It seems to me you're begging the question of why does it occur at certain moments and not at others? And you're saying it's in the text. If it's in the text, then it should occur all the time.
Well,
the Quran was there in Egypt when it was secular, and it's there when the religious movements come along.
I think it has occurred all the time. To answer your question in two parts, why is it not happening to the same degree among Jews and Christians at this moment? When you look at the history of Christianity and Judaism, and I'm not minimizing the role they're playing now, most of my writing is about not Islam, but about Christianity at this point. Christianity and Judaism have suffered a harrowing collision with modernity over the last 200 years. I mean, they have just had their religions mastered by science and secular politics and common sense to a degree that has not occurred in the Muslim world. The Muslim world has not had a reformation, and it has not had a renaissance. The Muslim world is amazingly isolated from the currents of criticism that have beaten back the fascistic and insane practice of religion that endured for centuries under Christendom. I mean, we were burning witches alive and heretics for 500 years in Europe. We're not doing that anymore, courtesy of scientific understanding of medicine, for one thing. I mean, we don't believe now that people are dying because their neighbor cast a spell on them. That's a good thing. That was hard fought, that battle, that war of ideas. And we would still be doing that but for the victories of reason and the Enlightenment. The only reason why anyone is a moderate now is because religion has lost the argument on so many fronts in our world. That has happened to a lesser degree in the Muslim world. This is undeniable. The Arab world is just a subset of the Muslim world. It's just 15% of Muslims. But the Arab world translates into Arabic. I have that backwards. That a country like Spain translates more into Spanish than the Arab world has translated into Arabic since the 9th century. Every year, Spain translates. So we're talking about real isolation. And that isolation has masqueraded in large part as there being no problem. I mean, we see a problem only at the borders, but the problem within any Muslim community is still visited upon Muslims. It's still visited upon women who, to an astonishing degree throughout the Muslim world, must suffer like pack animals under the subjugation of the men in their lives. I mean, honor killing is an utterly indefensible practice that is widespread, especially in the Muslim world, and it finds real sanctuary within the dictates of Islam.
All right. I got a few questions, but first, Chris respond.
You're talking about practices.
We've kept a very good tone up to now, so just another 15 minutes, and we'll have had a classic debate, and everybody will be happy.
You're talking about practices in a pre-modern society, and when people don't understand the cosmos and they don't understand human bodies, irregardless of religion, and you can read, you know, what anthropologists write from New Guinea or anywhere else when they deal with a pre-modern society, that's how they react. But to somehow blanket, you know, 1 billion people as pre-modern. I lived in Cairo. It's one of the most artistically and intellectually vibrant cities I've ever been in.
Let me just make it very clear. I'm not doing that. I'm not saying that all 1.4 billion Muslims are Al-Qaeda. Okay, I'm not saying that. And there's no doubt that some significant percentage of Muslims don't take their religion all that seriously. That is a good thing. I mean, so that they're moderate. They're moderate because they're not forcing their kids into madrasas and seeing everything through the prism of theology.
Sam,
but the point is, are we just disagreeing about sheer numbers? Or are you denying that any subset of the Muslim world
believes what you describe is how a pre-modern group or society exists anywhere on the planet, not just Muslims. That's how pre-modern societies work. That's how tribal societies work. They're superstitious. Honor killings, by the way, having lived in the Middle East for 7 years, are not that common. But let me talk a little bit about the mood of the Muslim world. I was in the Arab world after 9/11, covering Al-Qaeda, and there was absolute revulsion and shock and empathy for us for what happened. The chief Sunni Islamic leader, Sheikh Tantawi and Al-Azhar in Cairo, condemned the attacks of 9/11 as a crime against humanity and then went on to denounce Osama bin Laden as a fraud, somebody who had no theological training and no right to issue fatwas or religious edicts. The tragedy is not the fault of the Muslim world. What happened is that we fail to understand that the only way to fight terrorism is to isolate terrorists within their own society, not to begin dropping iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East. And what we did as a society was become tribal. We drank that dark elixir of American nationalism, which is not only a form of self-exaltation, but a form of racism. And anybody who didn't support us, including the French, including people who share our values and are our allies. Remember all the jokes about French culture and French identity? Let's remember the French were right. There were no weapons of mass destruction. He wasn't tied to Al-Qaeda. And let me finish.
Okay,
saying.
But you're arguing against positions I don't necessarily hold.
No, but I'm talking about the characteristic of the Muslim in the Arab world, which does not fit with the picture you're painting. And if we had had the courage to be vulnerable, if we had realized that this was a war of shadows, an intelligence war, we would have a huge percentage of the Muslim world on our side. And I can tell you that because I was on the streets of Tunisia, Cairo, Beirut. I was there.
Right. Well,
so let me just finish.
I'll give you a chance.
Okay.
You talk about, you dismiss this notion that somehow despair is unimportant, that these people react like barbarians because of the Quran. If you go back and read the great philosophers on totalitarianism on Nazi Germany, Hannah Arendt, Karl Popper, Fritz Stern, The Politics of Cultural Despair, they all write that what propelled the fascists forward, that what propels all totalitarian movements, and I include fundamentalists, Jewish fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists, Hindu fundamentalists, Karen Armstrong has done great work on this, what propels them forward is despair, personal and economic despair. And you see it within the United States with the Weimarization of the American working class, the rise of an American oligarchy, the huge disparities that are creating. You can't maintain a democracy in an oligarchic state. And what's at fault in the Arab world is not Islam, but scummy little dictatorships like the one run in Saudi Arabia or Hosni Mubarak's in Egypt. It's the political system that keeps most people crushed under their heel. Egypt is a deeply repressive state, which we give $3 billion a year to. And let's also finally not forget that every time Israel sends those F-16 jets and Apache helicopters to strike refugee camps in Gaza, the fragments of those bombs have Dayton, Ohio, and other cities on them. And we are complicitous very much in the suppression and abuse and killing of innocent Muslims.
Okay, well, let me deal with your taking the measure of the Muslim world. Happily, we do not assess public opinion by having New York Times journalists go out and live in the Muslim world and make friends and get a vibe. I mean, this is not... A single well-run opinion poll would be worth 1,000 years of you wandering around the Middle East.
Oh, well, I mean, come on.
No, that's not
wrong,
meant to be hyperbolic.
Wrong.
Well, let me tell you.
No.
How many?
You can't
possibly believe that about polls? My God.
All we've got are conversations. All we've got are conversations.
Man's lived there for 15 years, for God's sake.
How many people did you ask? How many people did you ask?
I've done it for 2 hours. How long, Go on.
How many people did you ask whether they supported suicide bombing? You could have lived there a long time and asked that question a lot and still not have done anything like the job that Pew did when they went into 9 countries and got a random sample, insofar as that was possible, of Muslims and asked 38,000 people that question. Okay, the responses were appalling. And the responses were appalling in countries that were the most cosmopolitan and the least benighted by pre-modern standards. There has been poll after poll after poll. None of them support this sanguine idea of public opinion.
I actually studied the Pew poll carefully, and what it said was that in the face of an occupation where the occupier is hurting your country and your people, that this is a legitimate attack because you don't have alternative That's what the Pew poll said.
It's in my book if you want to see the question. Yeah. The question was, do you support suicide bombing against non-combatants in defense of Islam? Okay. It is explicitly religious formulation of it. And it's suicide bombing, which, as Chris points out, there is a single line in the Quran which seems to suggest suicide is a bad idea. It's suicide bombing against non-combatants. And the support is astonishing. And the support is not... It's interesting to consider what level of support we would find consoling. 2%, 5%, 10%. 10% is still 140 million people in this world. But there were countries where it was 75% and 80%. And Turkey, the great Muslim success story, was down around 20%. So these are not...
Can I ask you just a question? I don't want to get people too angry, but I'll kick myself going out of here if I don't ask this question. But we had this war in Vietnam, and according to McNamara, 3.4 million people died. Mm-hmm. Died. Most of them civilians. Right? Most of them civilians. Is there a fundamental difference between killing 3.4 million people with this carpet bombing and Agent Orange or fragmentation bombs and suicide bombing? Is there a fundamental difference between suicide bombing and destroying Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all of the wood-based cities of Japan in World War II? Is there a fundamental moral difference?
I don't want to speak for a moment in defense of Vietnam even in defense of Hiroshima and things that could be given a plausible rationale for self-preservation. I think we could not fight war the way we fought war in World War II. We could not firebomb Dresden because we have too much information, because this information plays upon our nascent feelings of compassion, and that's a good thing. I think we should have all the information we can get about the horrors of war so as to inoculate us against going casually onto the battlefield. But suicide bombing is, when you think about it, something that really should be impossible. And it is the least rational thing, even worse than suicide bombing, celebrating the suicidal atrocities of your children, which, Chris, I understand the mothers you have met didn't appear to be doing that, but there's no question that some mothers do that, and this has been widely reported. If you really believe, it's a perfectly rational thing to feel. If you really believe that martyrdom is true, if you really believe that your dead child, who was there a moment ago, is now in paradise waiting for you and you will really be reunited, death is an illusion. And there are people who believe this, and there are people who express this belief violently in conflicts that have nothing to do with us. I mean, the war between Iran and Iraq was characterized on the Iranian side by this massive campaign of suicide bombing, where teenagers were just goaded out to clear minefields by their parents. We weren't involved. This is not, you know, the problem is not urban sprawl and NAFTA and the other degradations that Chris suggests lead people to despair. There's no doubt that despair is a variable, but it matters what you believe in your despair. And again, I would take you back to despairing Janes. They're not going to practice suicide bombing because they believe something different.
Let me just, because we're going to have to wrap it up, but people put in questions, so let me just summarize a bunch. Basically, the questions to you is, where do you get your moral values? Do you believe that religion and faith is the only path to save us from ourselves? What other paths might exist? Knowledge and rationality without compassion is dangerous. Where or how does compassion fit into the atheist? Where does an atheist go for moral guidance? That's about it, you know.
Well, there is this fear that if you lose the idea that one of your books was written by the creator of the universe, you will lose any real basis to have a durable morality. I think this fear is unfounded on many fronts. I mean, it clearly gets the process of consulting scripture backwards. I mean, we read the Bible, and we see that in Leviticus it says, you know, if a woman is not a virgin on her wedding night, you should take her to her father's doorstep and stone her to death. I mean, we read that, and we choose to reject that pearl of ancient wisdom. And then we read elsewhere in the Bible, we come across the golden rule, and we say, ah, now that's really wise. That makes sense. That feels good. That's how I want to be treated. This is really this is the true moral message of the Bible. So the process is we are the guarantors of the wisdom that we find in Scripture. I mean, the guarantors of our morality, the guarantor of our morality is in our brains, not in our books.
I just have to ask you, there are a few questions directed to you.
Let me just comment briefly on, you know, but because what you're positing is that there are such a thing as literalists. These people in the radical Christian right or all fundamentalist movement are not literalists. They're selective literalists. They pick and choose what they want. There are huge portions of these sacred documents that they don't accept. I mean, you know, they don't believe, as many writers of the Hebrew Bible did, that God is looking down at us through little peepholes in the sky called stars. There are whole injunctions in Leviticus, including killing a child for cursing your parent. And I think what's frightening about these movements is that they dismember and pick out some of the most hateful creeds and passages in the Bible to sanctify forms of oppression and violence. It's what antebellum slave owners did. And so there is no such thing as a literalist. Certainly out of the Bible, it's impossible. They're selective literalists that feeds a particularly bigoted creed.
Okay. Now, there are a few questions for you. Okay. The one I like is, what will happen to you when you die, and how do you know this? Another is, Christopher Hitchens recently told Bill Maher, this goes to sort of the theme of your book, that he believes Americans are less religious and more secular than they admit to pollsters, and U.S. church attendance figures bear this out. And then just let me tack on this one, because I teach at USC and I raise this with my students all the time. Does God really have a stake in the outcome of sporting events?
Well, we don't know what's going to happen to us when we die, you know, and that's part of sort of, you know, the mystery of human existence. We don't know. In terms of, are we more secular than we're religious, I would agree with Hitchens. I think that this movement is a secular movement under the guise of religion, because it is a radical mutation from traditional fundamentalism. Traditional fundamentalists always called on believers to remove themselves from contaminants of secular society and to shun political involvement. Traditional evangelicals, people like Billy Graham, Louis Palau, always warn believers about getting too close to political power. This is a radical mutation that calls for the assumption of power. and it is, you know, wrapped itself in the American flag and clutched the Christian cross. But at its core, it's a deeply secular movement. It has a warrior cult within it. Like all totalitarian movements, it embraces apocalyptic violence as a kind of cleansing agent to purge the world. It's a binary worldview of us and them. It attempts to delegitimize whole segments of American society. And I think that you know, for certainly serious readers of the Bible, even serious evangelicals or fundamentalists, you know, we're still using old terms to describe them. But this is a political movement, and it's a mass movement, and at its core, it is totalitarian. Finally, does God have a stake in sporting events? No.
See, my answer is I think that's the only thing he has a stake in. We have to wind this up because otherwise the overtime cost will bankrupt Truthdig and we won't be able to have another event. But I do want to, I know you guys, you'll be going in the car and you'll think, you know, that thing got all screwed up, Cher was a lousy moderator, et cetera, et cetera. So why don't you go first and then you go second and just tell us what we didn't get to that we should have and, you know, put the cap on it.
I think that what we're what Sam is fundamentally talking about is fundamentalism, especially this radical fundamentalism that we see within the Muslim world, that we see it within Jewish groups, certainly within the settler movement in Israel. We see it with Hindu nationalists. Fundamentalism, for me, is born out of desperation and despair. That's why it's growing as a movement. I think at its core, it's primarily secular because its objective is the assumption of power at the expense of others. And I think that finally the only way to fight these movements, both abroad and within our own country, is essentially to re-enfranchise these people within our societies. And if we don't re-enfranchise these people, if we allow our country to become a corporate or oligarchic state, the despotism that we watch deforming lives abroad will deform lives at home.
Well, let me give you a sense of what it's like to be me having this conversation. I mean, it seems to me we could have been having this conversation 500 years ago. And, you know, life was difficult 500 years ago. There was a lot of despair. There were crops failed and disease spread. And people suffered just instantaneous and catastrophic changes in their fortune. And it was the cause of all of this actually was well understood 500 years ago. It was witchcraft. And happily, the church had produced some very energetic men who had the gumption to deal with this problem. And so every year, some hundreds and sometimes thousands of women were burned alive for casting spells on their neighbors. Now, imagine what it would be like to be among the 5 or the 10% of people at most who recognize that the very belief in magic, the very belief in witchcraft, the very belief in good witches or bad witches was a malignant fantasy. The white witches who were helping people with medicinal herbs and practicing midwifery, they were on no firmer ground than the black witches who were casting the evil eye. The whole belief system was at fault. Imagine the kind of criticism you're going to get. No, your problem is just with kind of fundamentalist witchcraft. The reality is that witchcraft is far more nuanced than that, and there's no conflict between science and witchcraft. I mean, you know, science deals with physical law and physical causality, but witchcraft deals with potent spells and the internal connections between things. This idea that somehow we shouldn't call into question these patently bad ideas, for fear of offending people, for fear of glossing over their despair, for fear of not criticizing other problems in the world. I would never argue that religion is the only problem in the world or the only source of human conflict, but it is a source, and we are mightily attached to it, emotionally attached to it. And we are loath to criticize it, even when it is declaring its ugliest intentions and its ugliest certainties. The problem with the Bible is however you pick and choose, whether you're a literalist or a selective literalist, the problem is there's just a mountain of divisive nonsense in there, and that's where people get ideas about homosexuality being an abomination and why our country in the 21st century debates gay marriage as though it were the great moral issue of our time. This is coming from religion, and it seems to me that it's time we had an honest conversation about that.
Let me wrap this up by repeating what I said at the beginning. It's a real honor to be with these two people, that they evidence great integrity and courage. I remain an agnostic on their divisions. But I'm thrilled at a Truth Dig that we have published both of you, and that I hope we can continue to do that and keep the debate going and the discussion, because it is a very important one to have. And thanks for coming.
Thank you.